Okay, good morning. This is Bio 241. And let's see, I think you had a test last time in class. So it's graded. Your grades are on Blackboard. So everybody's grades are on Blackboard. And you'll be getting them back in lab. So those people that go to lab today will get their test back. Those of you that don't have lab today and you want to see your test, then you can see me during office hours. All right, and I can go over the test. You can look at the test. And, of course, everybody should look at the test to see how they did and how you read the question and why you answered the question a certain way. Okay. Generally, my impression is this semester, I think a lot of students typically did a lot better on the first exam than previous semesters. Congratulations pretty much to the whole class. That was really nice. But I know there's a really steep learning curve in this class. So I'm sure some students that can improve their grades by 20, 25 points. Okay, you just have to learn how to study for the particular tests. So anyway, for what it's worth, that doesn't mean too much to me, probably doesn't mean too much to you, because you're interested in your individual grade, right? Not the class average. But you know, you got to come see me during office hours to work the web questions, or in lab, you know, those guys are there to help you work all those problems in lab as well and prepare for the lecture exam. So I wouldn't leave lab a minute early, ever, right? I would just stay in there and work and form a study group in lab and maybe meet outside of classroom period with that study group. Even down by the dinosaur head, just come to this building. You don't even have to reserve a room in the library to do that. And SI, I'm sure, helps too. I don't have any correlation this semester with how your grades are going, but I'm sure there's a huge advantage to going to SI. And if you enjoy studying with the people in SI, you might want to meet with that group without your SI leader. Okay? So those are just some ideas I have. So if someone wants to talk to me about their study techniques and things like that, guess what one thing is that I want to see? I don't know if any of you have really utilized this at all, is what? Your weekly study plan to see how it's going, because that gives you some information on how to arrange your life and how much time you're studying and that kind of stuff, right? So that's probably pretty important. All right, so those of you that will be getting back the test today in lab, there is a policy, and the policy is that once a student gets their Scantron back and you can work with it by yourself and look at the test, they can't be regraded. So the only way that you can check to see if you have stray marks or smudges on your Scantron is to sit down immediately with an instructor and go over it with the answer key and see how it was graded. But once somebody surrenders that Scantron back to you and you can look at it by yourself, then that's the grade that you have, even if you have stray marks on your Scantron. And guess what? There are a lot of students that made notes in the margins right where the Scantron reader needs to see the tick mark so it knows what question is which. So there are a lot of stray marks on Scantron. So it's just like, for instance, if I pass out the sign-in sheet, which I have right here, so please sign in. All right. If after a lot of times this semester students have come up to me and said, oh, you know what, the day after, I forgot to sign the sign-in sheet. Can I sign it today? And, well, what do I have to tell students? I can't remember if you were in class yesterday or not, so of course you can't sign it. All right. So right now is the time to sign the sign-in sheet. All right. That's just a policy that I have. And the same thing for Scantrons. If you think you made a mess with the Scantron, make sure you look it over with an instructor first before you take it and go look at the answer key, okay? And we're happy to do that, right? And then what's really nice about that is then you could discuss the question with the instructor as well and get some other useful information, right? So that's important to do. All right, so what do I have to say if a student comes and says to me, next week, can you regrade my Scantron? Because I noticed something funny was happening on it. What do I have to say? I can't do that. All right. So before it's handed back to you is the perfect time to take advantage of that, right? Not after we turn it back to you. All right, so let's see, over the weekend I'll get some more study guides together, and so you can start working for that next test. And if anybody wants to see me today during my office hours, don't forget I got a class right after this one. But after that, after your lab, I'll be around if you want to take a look at your test. So does anybody have any questions? Anybody questions? No? Okay. All right, well, we were talking about enzymes last time, I do recall. And this thing right here, I'm sure is... Oh, we didn't get this far? Oh, you had a test last time. Okay, so where didn't we didn't get to here? I mean, Monday's class is actually ahead of you guys? That's amazing. How, so we didn't start chapter 4? Not at all. Ah, okay. All right, so guess what we're going to start? We're going to start enzymes. All right, so let me just say once again, because sometimes I have to listen to this tape to know how to put it on the internet. This is February 12th, and we're going to start chapter 4, which begins with enzymes today. Yes?
Actually, I do have a question.
Yeah, good.
Do you think that these chapters are the hardest section of the
class? Wow, you know, I've thought about that a lot, and I've talked to students a lot about that, and I would guess that maybe the chemistry chapter is the hardest, because it's very abstract, but some of the metabolic pathways are challenging to people, so I think it all depends on your background, and I'm not sure why, but so every part of the class is harder for a particular student, so there's a lot of diversity in which chapters are the hardest. But for instance, I will say that if you have a background in chemistry, that first test might have seemed really simple to you, really, really simple. And if you don't have a background in biochemistry and you don't adjust your study methods, then you might do actually pretty poor on the second test. So if you're not familiar with material, that's really when you have to spend the time and work with it. Okay? So, did that make sense at all? Yeah. So if you're really, like if you're really familiar with cells and you took a test on cells, like we did last time, and then we move into a different topic that you're not familiar with, you have to apply yourself more. So, you just have to keep adjusting through the semester. Okay, enzymes. Let's talk about some enzymes. This is actually, I don't know, this is all really kind of fun stuff. Enzymes are fun to learn about, actually. They're biological catalysts, and let's just talk for a second, what the heck is a catalyst? What is a catalyst? Catalyst is... Yeah, that's a pretty serious definition. But I like that definition, okay? A catalyst is something that, what, promotes some kind of activity, right? Like you could be a catalyst for a study group by saying, what, grab somebody and say, hey, we're going to have coffee and donuts on Tuesday. Come on in, let's get together and study or something like that. So a catalyst is something that makes something happen, but a catalyst in terms of a chemical reaction, okay, you're correct, is something that speeds up the rate of a reaction. It speeds up the rate of a reaction. A catalyst can't make a reaction happen that is thermodynamically unfavorable. It can't make a reaction happen that won't happen by itself. It just speeds up the rate of a reaction that will eventually occur. That's what a catalyst does. And there are many inorganic catalysts that are used in chemistry. But in our bodies, guess what? We have catalysts, but they are biological catalysts, which means that they are proteins. Most biological catalysts are proteins. What's the building block of a protein? Amino acids, right? What's the sequence of amino acids called? That's called the primary structure, right? And the primary structure, right, is the building block for secondary structure, and secondary structure is the building block for tertiary structure, or the overall shape of that particular protein. So shapes of all proteins are very important because it determines their function, right? So the shape of a biological catalyst is very important too. The shape of an enzyme is very important, all right? And so an enzyme is something that increases the rate of a chemical reaction. And how does it do that? It does that by and this is where your idea is extremely important, is why? It lowers the activation energy for that particular reaction. It lowers the activation energy for a particular reaction. So, I tell you what, let's consider something sort of abstract, like all this wood that you're writing on right now. Okay, let's just pretend it's wood. I don't know, maybe it's plastic, but let's just say it's wood. Okay. That wood is fairly stable, but it's really wanting to turn into something else. What is it wanting to turn into? All by itself. Okay, so if we have wood right here, which is what? Cellulose. All right, and cellulose is kind of like a special form of starch. What's the building block of starch? Glucose, yeah. So wood really is made out of glucose molecules. But in our bodies, we have glycogen and starch. You could think of starch as being put together like this, right? One molecule after another of glucose. In cellulose, it's like that. It just flipped a little bit. And when it's flipped, that means that that glucose is no longer soluble in water. So cellulose is not soluble, but nonetheless, it's a polymer of glucose. So why is it a really good thing that cellulose isn't soluble in water? Why is that? Because if it were to rain outside, what would happen to all the trees? They would just dissolve away, right? So that little bond makes all the difference in the world. So cellulose, the basic building block of cellulose is glucose. All right, that's wood. And what do you know about wood? It has a lot of energy stored in chemical bonds. So wood wants to turn into carbon dioxide and water. What do we call that process? That's like when you burn wood, right? So here we have all this wood, and it's dying to turn into carbon dioxide and water, but there's something preventing it from happening, right? That is the activation energy. There's an energy barrier that's preventing wood from turning into carbon dioxide and water. But, right, if we were really motivated, how could we turn all this wood into carbon dioxide and water? Okay, by increasing energy of the system. Right, we could introduce energy, we could apply energy to wood, and what form would that be? Like a match or something, or a lighter. Right, so we increase the energy of that wood, and what's going to happen? It's going to burn, right? So that is going to produce carbon dioxide and water. So if we were to wait a million years, all this wood eventually will turn into carbon dioxide and water, even at a low temperature. But if we increase the energy, it happens faster. Okay, but you know, there are some organisms that can utilize the energy in cellulose and very rapidly turn it into carbon dioxide and water. What is that? Anybody know what that little organism is? Like a termite, for instance. All right, so a termite can chew on wood, and what is a termite really eating? It's really eating glucose. And the termites have enzymes. Actually, there's a bacteria in the termite that can digest wood, get the energy out of it, and then release carbon dioxide and water. And if anybody ever see a termite? Yeah? Do they have like a little furnace inside of them? You see a little burning flame or anything? No? Okay. Because what does a termite have? It has an enzyme that automatically reduces the activation energy. So a termite doesn't have to burn wood. But nonetheless, it can still get the energy out of glucose. All right, there's another chemical compound, H2O2. Anybody know what H2O2 is? You probably all, not everybody has it, but I would guess most of us have this at home. All right, this is hydrogen peroxide. All right, and why would we have hydrogen peroxide at home? Like, for instance, if you cut yourself, you lacerate your finger, you pour hydrogen peroxide on it, and it's nice because it helps prevent infection. All right, so hydrogen peroxide, right, produces oxygen and water, H2O, and you could probably balance that equation for me. I won't bother to do that right now. But, okay, that hydrogen peroxide bottle that you have in your medicine cabinet, what kind of bottle is it in? Okay, dark, right? It's a dark plastic bottle, so light can't get into it. Because hydrogen peroxide all by itself wants to do what? Be converted into oxygen and water. And if you've had that same hydrogen peroxide bottle in your medicine cabinet for 20 years, the last 20 years, then when you open it up, guess what's in that bottle? Probably it's only oxygen and water. And the oxygen, yeah, as soon as you open up, the cap goes out. So hydrogen peroxide automatically wants to convert into water and oxygen. And if you increase the energy, like by shining light on it, it's going to convert faster because light is energy. So that's why they put it in a really dark bottle. Okay? All right, but for your particular purposes, what do we do with hydrogen peroxide? When you have a cut, you pour hydrogen peroxide, for instance, on your finger, and what do you see? It starts to bubble and foam and all that kind of stuff. And that's really a good thing because what's happening is this hydrogen peroxide, the rate of conversion increases, it's speeded up. All right, so that oxygen is a bacteriostatic agent that helps kill bacteria. And the water in that reaction that's being produced flushes the wound out, right? So that's a really nice thing to put on wounds, to clean it up and to prevent an infection. So how did the rate of that chemical reaction speed up from happening, instead of happening in 20 or 30 years, it happens all in 1 second. Guess what's used? What is used to speed up the rate of a chemical reaction? It is a, it's a catalyst. Right, so a catalyst speeds up the rate of a reaction. And what do you have in your finger? You have biological catalysts, in particular enzymes. So here is an enzyme that you have in your finger that's called catalase. So catalase is specifically designed to break down hydrogen peroxide into oxygen and water. And so what does that do? It speeds up the rate of the reaction, so it happens right away. Catalase cannot take oxygen and water and make hydrogen peroxide, right? It can't, because that's unfavorable. It can only speed up the rate of going from hydrogen peroxide to oxygen and water. Okay. And catalase is an enzyme. It's a biological catalyst. So you might wonder, okay, let's take a look at this figure right here. Okay, so we have a bunch of graphs on this particular slide. This is a plot of number of reactant molecules. Now, can you all remember what a chemical reaction is? You've got A plus B going to what? C plus D. So these over here are what we call the reactants, and these are the products. Right here, this is just for any kind of typical chemical reaction. In an enzyme-catalyzed reaction, we don't really call these reactants. We like to call these substrates. Substrates. Okay, so here we have a plot of number of reactant molecules or substrates plotted against the energy of the different reactants that are in solution. So when you have a jar of something, not all of those molecules in that jar, they have exactly the same energy. There's just a nice bell-shaped distribution of energy, right? And as we move out over here, it means what? Some molecules have higher energy than others. So on this end of the bell-shaped curve, these are the molecules that have high energy. And in this shaded region right here, this is the percentage that have sufficient energy to undergo the reaction. Right, and you can see it's what? Kind of a small number of molecules. All right, let's look at the plot underneath it right here. So here we have a graph of energy, right, which is this graph right over here, versus the reaction. And so here is a reactant. I don't know what happened to the last part of this word right here. Here's a reactant, all right, and it's going to be converted into products. But what does this reactant have to acquire before products can form? So for instance, let's just say this is wood here and this is carbon dioxide and water. What does this wood right here have to acquire? It has to acquire some kind of energy because here is an energy barrier. We call this activation energy. All right, and once that wood starts burning, this energy is paid back, but it's necessary to start the reaction, to get the reaction to start happening. Okay, so the reactants have to get over this energy barrier, and then of course it can release a lot of energy into the system. Okay, another maybe nice way that I think about this is, for instance, can you remember my car that I talked about before? All right, here is that MGB. And what does that car want to do? Roll up the hill or down the hill? Okay, it wants to roll down, right? But sometimes maybe I don't want the car to roll down the hill. So what would I do? I wouldn't trust the parking brake. As a matter of fact, there isn't much I would trust in that car. So what would I do? I would put a chalk right there, okay, or a block or something. And that block is going to prevent the car from rolling down the hill. Does the car still want to roll down the hill? Absolutely. It's just that this block is preventing it, right? So how could I get this car to roll down the hill, say maybe the starter motor wasn't working, with the chalk right here? What would I have to do? Maybe I could get a friend with a big bus or a truck or something, right, and hit the car, right? And what would happen then? It would hop over this block right here and then start rolling down the hill, and then I could pop the clutch, right? Well, what's a more elegant way of getting the car rolling down the hill? Okay, well, yeah, start, use the key. Yeah, I finally figured that out. I bought a different car. Okay. But say I was stuck with this car. I didn't have any friends because it was 11:30 at night, all right? And my car was behind this block right here, and I wanted to get it started. What is a more elegant way of getting my car started? Just what? Remove the block. Take the block away. And then with my big toe, I could get my car started, all right, down the hill. All right, so removing the block is analogous to what? Using a catalyst for this particular reaction right here. What a catalyst does is that it removes or reduces that activation energy somehow. All right, so that's just an analogy of how to think of activation energy. All right, so on the curves over here on the right, we see that if we were to add energy to this system right here by maybe increasing the temperature or shaking it up or shining light on it or somehow adding energy to the system, what has happened to the number of molecules that have the proper activation energy to undergo the reaction? Has it increased or decreased or stayed the same? It has increased, right? Now, so now almost half of the molecules have the energy to do that, so now the reactants can hop over this activation energy to form products. Another way of thinking about what an enzyme does is, let's just say, let's build a molecule right here. Okay, so here are the reactants or the substrates. I got these two markers, and let's just make one marker out of them. All right, so black and blue over here. So that is that's the product molecule. And in order for a product to form, how do these molecules have to fit together? Exactly this one way, right? With black over here on my right side and blue on my left. All right, they have to touch up exactly like that. But let's just say, how many different ways can these molecules bump into each other? They can bump into each other like this, or like that, or like that, or like this, or like that. And will a product molecule form if they bump into each other like that? How many different ways can these two molecules bump into each other to form a product? Only one way. How many other ways can they bump into each other? Well, I don't know. There's probably a million different ways. And if they bump into each other in those million different ways, a product is not going to form, right? So that's one way to think of the activation energy, reducing activation energy. What an enzyme does is that it takes the substrates, puts them together in just the exact one way so that product will form. And it prevents them from bumping into each other in all kinds of weird, strange ways. The other nice thing about what an enzyme does is when it puts these molecules together in just the right way, what do you get out of this? This is the molecule that you want. This is the one that's beneficial to your body. Sometimes when these substrates bump into each other, okay, maybe like this or like that, right, they get used up and they form this product. And what good is this product right here? It probably isn't very good for your body. It might even be a toxic compound. All right, so the beauty of an enzyme, which isn't on this slide right here, this is sort of an advanced concept, is that an enzyme produces just one product that you want, and it prevents the formation of what we call side reactions. So it increases the yield of a reaction to the product that your body can utilize and prevents, right, the inappropriate building of other molecules that are of no use or maybe even harmful to your body. So that's really a nice thing about enzymes. Okay? So is that helpful to think about it in terms of molecules bumping into each other? Well, let's continue with enzymes and maybe we can see why that is important. Okay, so the mechanism of enzyme action. So the ability of enzymes to lower energy requirement is due to the structure of that particular protein, right? The tertiary structure of that molecule. Enzymes have a highly ordered three-dimensional shape. We call that the conformation of that particular protein. And that protein has different pockets that can bind a substrate. We call that the active site. And what can you tell me about the relationship of this active site compared to a substrate if it's going to bind? Yeah, it's got to fit together, right? It's got to be complementary. The shapes have to be complementary. We call that the lock and key model. So in order for a lock to, no, in order for a key to work a lock, the key has to have the right shape. It's got to be complementary to the lock. Not only just to fit in, but it's got to have the right shape so that you can turn the tumblers to open the lock up. Same thing for enzymes. Enzymes act. Enzymes reduce the activation energy by bringing substrates close together so that they can react to form the products. That's really important. So here is where I was going to start the lecture, but I'm sure this is an exam figure for you. This is real important. Okay, so what do we see up over here? We see two substrates, A and B, and then here is the enzyme. And notice that there are some pockets in the enzyme right here that allow these substrates to fit in just perfectly. All right? And when they fit in perfectly, this area of substrate A will touch this area of substrate B, and a reaction can take place just in this region right here. Right? And these molecules have to touch just in that orientation in order for a reaction to take place. So substrate B binds to the enzyme, substrate A binds to the enzyme, and a new molecule is formed. This is what we call the enzyme-substrate complex. This is important because if the enzyme-substrate complex can't form, then the product can't form either. Right? So if somehow we inhibit the formation of the enzyme-substrate complex, we can't get the products to form. Okay. And so then we're left with products and this enzyme right here. All right, so in this reaction right here, we see reactants going to products, or the substrates going to products right here that's catalyzed by this enzymatic reaction. What molecule is being used up? What molecule goes away over time? Or what molecules are depleted as a result of this chemical reaction? The substrates go away. Okay, because you're using these things, right, to make what? What is actually forming during this chemical reaction? The products, that's right. So the substrates go away and the products appear as a result of this chemical reaction. All right, now what can you tell me about this enzyme right here after the reaction? How is it different from the enzyme before the reaction? Can you take a look at it? It looks what? It has the same shape. And you know what? The activity of that enzyme does not change after the reaction compared to how it was before the reaction. So an enzyme does not get used up during the reaction. The only thing that gets used up are what? The substrates, because they're converted into products. So this enzyme can catalyze that reaction over and over and over and over again, right? And it doesn't get used up. But since it's a protein, it doesn't have a lifetime of forever, right? It does degrade, but that's okay because a cell can make more of this kind of protein if need be. All right? So that's something very important about any kind of catalytic reaction, and that is the catalyst does not get used up during the reaction. It can sit there and form products thousands of times a second. Okay, it doesn't get used up. So that's a really good thing about enzymes. All right, so don't forget, these substrates have to fit into the active sites. The enzyme-substrate complex has to form before products are formed. Right, then the reaction occurs, the products dissociate, and you're left with an unaltered enzyme. Those are all some very important things to appreciate about enzymatic activity. Okay, let's talk about naming enzymes. This convention is fairly recent. You might learn some names of enzymes that don't follow this convention, and that's because they were discovered a long time ago. But today, if someone is ever working with an enzyme or discover an enzyme, we always put an ASE on the end of the word. All right, so if you ever see a word with ASE on the end of it, you should know it is a, it's an enzyme, right? Oh, you know, I want to go back just a second. Okay. So here we have this enzyme, and what does it have in order to perform this chemical reaction, in order to catalyze this reaction? In order to have this function of catalyzing the reaction, what does the enzyme have to have? It has to have, right, these active sites right here, and how do you know these are active sites when you look at it? It's by the shape of the enzyme or the shape of the active site. So in order for this enzyme to have the proper activity, it has to have the proper shape of the binding sites or the active site right here. So this is a nice, interesting structural functional relationship that we see at the molecular level. In order for molecules to have the proper function, they have to have the proper shape. And if you change the shape of this enzyme, guess what happens to its function? It changes as well, right? It might speed up or slow down. Most likely, it will slow down. Okay, so here's a nice structure-function relationship. All right, so enzymes, we put an ASE at the end of it so that we know that they are enzymes. Some enzymes are named according to their activity, what kinds of reactions they catalyze, such as a phosphatase. Right, you see an ASE right here. That means that this is an enzyme, and it has something to do with what? A phosphate functional group of some kind. All right, and a phosphatase is an enzyme that removes a phosphate group from a larger molecule. That would be a phosphatase. So that could be a big protein that is dephosphorylated. That happens with a phosphatase. There might be other molecules where a phosphate group is added to it. Right, and that's what we call a kinase. So a kinase is an enzyme that adds a phosphate group to another molecule. And when that phosphate, can you picture what that phosphate group looks like? Is it a small molecule like a hydrogen ion, or is it a big molecule? It's pretty big, right? It's got a phosphate, and it's got all those oxygens and other hydrogens on it. All right, so guess what happens when, for instance, let's take this enzyme right here. If we were to put on a phosphate group right here, a big molecule, if we were to add it with a kinase, for instance, what would happen to the shape of this enzyme right here? What's the model that I like to use in class? Okay, like somebody takes a finger and pokes you in the side, what are you going to do? You're going to undergo a conformation change, right? So when this enzyme is phosphorylated, it's going to change shape. And then what happens to the active sites right here? The activity of these active sites will change as well. So phosphorylating enzymes can drastically change their activity. Sometimes it increases the activity, sometimes it decreases the activity. You have to know for each particular system. All right? But don't forget that phosphate changes the conformation of that enzyme, which changes its activity. Okay. Other enzymes are named by the substrate that they catalyze. Like, for instance, lactate dehydrogenase works on lactate. We're going to see where lactate is. Maybe some of you have heard of lactate. When you exercise very strenuously, your muscles produce a lot of lactate, and that produces muscle fatigue and even soreness in that particular muscle. And dehydrogenase means what? It removes a hydrogen atom, yeah, from that particular molecule. And you know that's an enzyme because of ASE right here. Okay, here are a number of important enzymes that we have in our body. Catalase we've talked about already, because hydrogen peroxide is produced in some biochemical reactions in your body, and hydrogen peroxide is pretty toxic. It's highly reactive, as you see when you pour hydrogen peroxide on your body. So there are catalase is produced in cells to get rid of hydrogen peroxide right away into what? Water and oxygen. And are these toxic to you? No, right? So it converts a toxic compound into these very beneficial compounds to have in your body. And what part of the cell specifically has catalase in it? What part of a cell? It's in a vesicle. What vesicle did you learn is important for what? For detoxification. That's a peroxisome. So peroxisome contains peroxidase or catalase type enzymes that break down these highly reactive molecules. Carbonic anhydrase is an enzyme that can interconvert carbonic acid with CO2. And we're going to see that your body produces CO2 through some metabolic pathways, and this enzyme right here, carbonic anhydrase, converts it into carbonic acid, and then that acid dissociates into bicarbonate, and that's one way that your body can transport carbon dioxide everywhere it wants, because it gets converted into bicarbonate very easily, and bicarbonate dissolves in water. A tremendous amount of bicarbonate can dissolve in water, more so than carbon dioxide. So that's important for transport of CO2 around in your body. Amylase breaks down starch. What's the building block of starch? Glucose. How many glucoses are in starch? Okay, a lot. Thousands. Maybe 10,000, right? Depending on the starch molecule. Well, amylase will break starch down into this disaccharide, which is what? Just two glucoses put together. All right, but in what? The right form, so that it is still soluble. Here's that lactate dehydrogenase that we talked about. And then ribonuclease is going to work on what kind of molecule? RNA. Okay, so that's going to hydrolyze RNA into what? Ribonucleotides. So deoxyribonucleotides or ribonucleotides, that's the function of a ribonuclease. And of course your body has these because your body wants to protect it from DNA sequences that find your way into your body that don't belong to you, right? And you need to get rid of those. So these are ubiquitous, found all over the place. Okay, so how do we talk about enzyme activity? What is a good definition for enzyme activity? It is the rate at which substrates are converted into products. Could we say that enzyme activity is the rate at which an enzyme is used up? Would that be good? No. Why is that not a good idea? Because enzymes don't get used up when they catalyze a reaction, right? So that would not be a good way of thinking about it. It's the rate at which substrates are used up and converted into products. That's the rate of this particular chemical reaction. So we have a number of plots right here of enzyme activity versus temperature. We have enzyme activity versus pH. All right, so this is what? The rate at which products are being used up or reactants are formed, one way or the other. And I think that's what you did in lab this week, is look at the utilization of oxygen, how much oxygen is used up when you do your little mouse experiment. Or do we have mice this week, or do we have rats or rabbits, or what do we have?
Mice.
Okay. All right, so your mouse experiment, this is the kind of plot that you can make, for instance, with that particular experiment. And you notice that this line right here is not a flat line. Enzyme activity is not constant with temperature. You can see that when you increase the temperature, what happens to the rate of a chemical reaction? It goes up, right? Because what's really happening when you increase the temperature of a solution? Let's just say it's cold. Here we have two substrates. What are these substrates doing? They are, they bumped into each other. All right, it's cold. They bumped into each other again. Molecular motion is what? Slow. All right, and if we heat the solution up, what happens to the rate of bumping of these two molecules? Oh, it's faster, a lot faster. All right, so this increases the rate of a reaction because maybe they bump into each other just the right way. So that even helps enzymatically catalyzed reactions. So as the temperature increases, right, the mobility of those molecules increases, that increases the rate. But then what happens when you get to a certain temperature? It drops precipitously. All right, so how would you explain this big drop in enzyme activity? What's happening? Okay, that's right. You denature a protein. And we do this all the time, daily, right? We denature proteins. And I can't remember if I told you this story yet. Did I tell you about the... and it wasn't the chicken. Let's do hamburger, okay? If you have some raw hamburger, okay, and you cook it, does raw hamburger look the same as cooked hamburger? No, because what have you really done to that hamburger? You've denatured it, right? And you've changed the conformation of that protein. It's been denatured. Now, here is the next thought. So you've cooked that hamburger, you've made the temperature really high, and then you decrease the temperature. Does it go back All right, does this curve go back exactly the same way? Okay, once you denature a protein, right, you've changed its conformation, its shape, and when the shape changes, what happens to the function of that protein? It changes as well, right? So, and for instance, this just happened to me last night. Okay, I just cooked some hamburger. I was ready to sit down and have a nice dinner, right? And then I got a phone call. Oh, thanks for the sign-in sheet. I got a phone call from, oh yeah, let's pass it up, let's pass it around some more. Yeah, make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. And of course it was raw before I put it on the barbecue. And right as I was ready to sit down and eat, I got a phone call from some friends and they say, hey, pool table just opened up. And you have to, and we only have three people. You're the fourth person, you got to come down and shoot some pool with us. And I said, oh, I'm sorry, I just made this hamburger and I have to eat this hamburger. And so is that a good excuse for not going and shooting some pool with your friends after they call you up and said they needed you? You have to say, oh, well, okay. So took the hamburger, put it in the refrigerator after I cooked it. Does that raw hamburger go back to looking like raw hamburger? No. No, right? So going after you denature something, it is always going to be denatured. What do we call that process? All right? It's a one-way street. It is irreversible, right? Once a protein is denatured, you can't get it back into its native conformation, no matter what you do with it. And as a result, that activity of that enzyme has been forever changed as well, as a result. Okay, so temperature can denature. That's what we see in this particular process over here, because the three-dimensional shape of that enzyme has been changed. So the structure of these proteins is fairly delicate. Right, they're wiggling and bending and vibrating, and when we increase the temperature, they wiggle and vibrate faster and faster and faster. What kind of bonds hold the tertiary structure of a protein together? What kind of bonds? Mostly hydrogen, a few ionic. What can you tell me is strength about a hydrogen bond? Is it strong or weak? It's weak. So when we increase the temperature, those bonds break, right? The protein changes shape, and it can never go back to the original conformation. Okay, so temperature changes the shape because it changes how these molecules wiggle around. And if anybody knows of an example of when you denature a protein, how you can reverse it to go back to its original shape, I'd be really interested to know if anybody knows that. I only, because there's always an exception to a rule. And I only know one exception. For instance, hair, that's right. Because when somebody gets a permanent, what are we doing to the proteins in those strands of hair? We're changing their conformation with probably relatively rough chemical treatment, right? Should only be done with somebody that really knows what they're doing. Otherwise, probably all your hair is going to fall out, right? Okay. So a permanent can put, what, a different conformation into those keratin strands that make up a hair. And then you could go from straight hair, if you had straight hair, to curly hair. Or you could go from curly hair back to straight hair by reducing those bonds, and those are bonds with those sulfhydryl groups with different amino acids in keratin. Okay, so that's the only way that I know of how to reverse a denatured protein is what to have a permanent and then a, what do you call it, an anti-permanent? What do you have? What do you call it when you get a permanent taken out of your hair? I'm not sure. It's what? Straightening? It's just called straight. Ah, okay. They're not chemists. Okay. But there's probably a name for that. All right, but also, what are some other ways that you can cook a protein? How else could you cook something that you wanted to eat? You could fry it. That's temperature. How else? Yeah, that's temperature. So how else could you cook it without temperature, without increasing the temperature? With lemon, for instance. I couldn't quite hear what you said, but lemon. What is lemon? It is an acid, right? So by changing the pH of these proteins, you can get them to change conformation. And so, for instance, like ceviche, which is fish that's been cooked with lemon, but it's at low temperature, you don't have to even heat it, it changes conformation, and that changes the activity that preserves the food, changes the consistency of the food. What's another way that you can preserve food besides acid? Salt, for instance, changes the shape of these molecules, which changes the conformation and activity of all the enzymes, so that preserves food as well. So on this slide right here, All right. So, for instance, maybe you could try this at home. If you make ceviche sometime and you take it out of the lemon juice and wash all the acid off, does it go back to looking like raw fish? Never, right? It's an irreversible process. Okay, so all enzymes will have a particular shape at a particular pH, and some enzymes have evolved to work at low pHs, and some have evolved to work at high pHs. For instance, enzymes that work in the stomach, like pepsin, have an optimal pH that's between 1 and 2. They have just the right shape at that particular pH because that's what's necessary to break apart a very tough covalent bond, namely peptide bonds. It needs a very rough environment, pH 2. So this enzyme works at that pH. All right, and then things move out of the stomach into what part of your anatomy? Into your small intestine. And there the pH then switches the other way, becomes very basic. And trypsin then finishes the digestion of proteins at a very high pH. So trypsin has an optimal activity at around pH 8. And then most other places in your body are more, what, neutral. So for instance, amylase, salivary amylase, has an optimal activity right around pH 7. Okay, so, and what's the job of amylase again? It breaks down starch into maltose, right? And I suppose even if you let it work a long time, into glucose. So this is some initial digestion of starch takes place in the mouth. Okay, so here are a bunch of enzymes and the pH. You can look this over, which ones are important. Well, I think if you just look at some of these, you can see the nomenclature, ASE, ASE, okay, ASE over here. Some of the older enzymes don't follow that convention, so you might just become familiar with that these are all enzymes. And of course, what's the substrate for lipase, just as a test of your understanding of convention? Yeah, fats or lipids, right? So it's something that will break lipids down. Okay. Some chemical reactions require very small amounts of other kinds of compounds besides substrates and enzymes. They require other little things that we call cofactors or coenzymes. All right, so these things are necessary for the normal activity of enzymes. So you got an enzyme, you've got substrates, but you might need something else as well, either a cofactor or a coenzyme. A cofactor is a very small metal ion, and in a lot of cases it could be a calcium ion or it could be magnesium, and even in some other cases it's manganese or copper or zinc, selenium, and these you need in very small quantities of your body because you don't use them up. These just participate in a reaction and are not used up like an enzyme. So we call these cofactors. Without cofactors, the rate of that chemical reaction will decrease. But they're not really an enzyme because they're not proteins, right? They're just very, very small ions. And then there are other molecules that are very, very large and organic. They're not small inorganic elements. These are what we call coenzymes. And these are derived from vitamins. These transport small molecules needed by enzymes in order to do their job. So a way to think about a coenzyme is that it works a lot like a transfer RNA. It's going to carry some small molecule from maybe one part of a cell to another, or from one set of chemical reactions to another set of chemical reactions. It's going to carry a product from one set of reactions to another. So it's a carrier molecule. So, and because they're organic and very large, we call them coenzymes and not cofactors. But again, if you don't have that coenzyme, then the rate of that reaction is going to decrease as a result. So what's a good way to think of cofactors and coenzymes? Well, this is a good illustration of how a cofactor might work. Not necessarily a coenzyme, but a cofactor. All right, so here you have an enzyme, and we see that the enzyme has a certain conformation, but it doesn't really have quite the right shape in the active site right here to bind the substrates. But there is another binding site other than the active site where this cofactor will bind, and when it binds, what happens to the conformation of the enzyme? What's that doing? It's like poking you in the side, right? That's going to change conformation of the enzyme. So now the active site has the more proper shape, and so the substrates can bind and the chemical reaction will speed up. So this is a good example of, for instance, a cofactor. Another example would be, so where it binds is where? Some site other than the active site, but it might actually bind within the active site as well. That's a second kind of circumstance. So when the cofactor binds to the active site, now the active site has the right shape. Right? So what do we call this moiety right here? This has to form before products are formed. This is what we call the enzyme substrate complex, right? The enzyme substrate complex. So this cofactor is necessary in order for the enzyme substrate complex to form, and if it didn't form, then of course you don't get any products formed. So think of a cofactor as just this very, very small molecule that changes the shape of the active site so that the enzyme substrate complex can form. Many enzymes are produced in an inactive form. For instance, the pancreas. One function of the pancreas is to produce digestive enzymes, and it would be a really poor idea to have those digestive enzymes activated in the pancreas, because what would happen to the pancreas? It would be digested, right? And that's certainly what happens during pancreatitis or when you have pancreatic cancer. And you can imagine how difficult those particular pathologies are to treat. Very, very difficult, right? So under normal circumstances, the pancreas synthesizes and releases digestive enzymes that are inactive. And that protects against self-digestion. And once they're in their proper location, they become activated. And many are activated by phosphorylation. What kind of enzyme is going to phosphorylate an enzyme to activate it? That's called a kinase. A kinase phosphorylates a protein. Right? And many other enzymes are inactivated by dephosphorylation. What's the name of an enzyme that will dephosphorylate something? That's a phosphatase. So you got to kind of develop just a little understanding of that. Right, so that it's not, so you don't have to think too hard to remember that. So that's probably something good for you to memorize, what the activity of a kinase is versus a phosphatase. Others are activated by small molecules we call ligands, and some of those ligands are actually second messengers. Right, so how does this second messenger develop inside of a cell? What causes the production of a second messenger? The binding of a first messenger to some membrane receptor, right? Okay. All right, so these ligands are produced by some kind of signaling molecule that's trapped outside the cell that binds to a receptor molecule. All right. Well, let's not think about receptor molecules right now. This graph is going to look similar to receptors that we've already looked at. Here's a plot of the reaction rate versus substrate concentration. All right, so reaction rate. So what again? What is reaction rate? What kind of molecule are you going to think about when you see reaction rate right here? Enzyme, for instance, right? All right, so the rate of this reaction is going to be, it could be one of two things. What could it be? It could be the disappearance of substrate or the appearance of the product. Either one, whichever easier to measure, right? That's going to give us a rate, the change over time, the change in substrate concentration over time is the reaction rate versus substrate concentration. And we're not changing enzyme concentration. We're keeping enzyme concentration the same. We're only changing substrate concentration. So if we have zero substrate, what's the rate of the reaction? Does the reaction take place with no substrate? No, right? So here we have zero. And as we increase the rate of the substrate, what happens to the rate of the reaction? It starts to take place and convert substrate into products, right? So it is, it's more mostly directly related to substrate concentration. And as we increase the substrate concentration, then the what's happening to the rate right here? It levels off. What do we call that leveling off of the chemical reaction? That's saturation, right? Because all of the enzyme now is bound to substrate, so there's no extra enzyme to catalyze the reaction any further. If we put more substrate in, all the active sites are bound up and the reaction rate can't increase any further. So this is what we call saturation. All right, but there are two other ways that we can characterize an enzyme, just the same way that we characterized a receptor. What are the three characteristics of a receptor? One was saturation. This was on the test. Specificity, that means that the shape of the substrates have to have the right shape to bind to the active sites. That's specificity. And what's the other thing?
Competition.
So if you have other molecules that look like substrates, they can bind to the active site as well. And when they do, that lowers the rate of the reaction because when they're in the binding site, then they're preventing the enzyme substrate complex to form with the proper substrate if there's somebody else in there. Okay? So enzymatic reactions exhibit saturation, specificity, and competition as well, just like receptor molecules. So in a lot of sense, you could think of a receptor as being what? An enzyme. And in a lot of sense, you could think of an enzyme as being a receptor because it shares many of the same kinds of properties, and that is, it has that binding site. The reason why they work is because of the shape of the molecules. Okay. All right. This is a real important slide right here to give you a feel how things work. Okay, in our bodies. Reversible reactions. For instance, we looked at this one when we take water and carbon dioxide and it can produce carbonic acid. And look at this arrow right here. Which way is this arrow pointing? Both ways. Okay? And that's because the free energy of water and carbon dioxide, if we were to add that together, is about equal to the free energy of carbonic acid. So there are no major energy changes right here between all of these different molecules. All right, so some chemical reactions are reversible. Both the forward and backward reactions are catalyzed with the same enzyme. Now, can you recall the enzyme that catalyzes this reaction? It's called? Catalase was converting hydrogen peroxide into oxygen and water. Okay, so that's catalase, so that's not this one here. This is carbonic anhydrase. Carbonic anhydrase can interconvert these substrates into this product or can interconvert this product into these substrates right here, depending on the concentration of these different kinds of chemicals. And this is what we call the law of mass action. It has another name some people might be familiar with, and I should put it on the slide right here because I can't spell it on the board. It's called Le Chatelier's principle. All right, I don't know if anybody's run into Le Chatelier's principle, but it just says, for instance, if we have this reaction right here and we add a bunch of water to the left-hand side of this equation, it's going to force the reaction to go to the right. It's going to produce a lot of carbonic acid. Conversely, right, if we take a lot of water away, what's going to happen? It's going to force the reaction to the left. It's going to take carbonic acid and produce a lot of CO2 and try to build some of that water back up. So that is the law of mass action. The direction of the reaction is from side of the equation where the concentration is higher to the side where the concentration is lower. So if we add carbonic acid right here, which way is this reaction going to go? If we add carbonic acid, it's going to go to the left, right? All right, so what does your body produce all the time? Right here. So if your body puts in, if your body produces a lot of CO2, which way is that going to drive this reaction? It's going to drive it to the, it's going to drive it to the right. It's going to produce a lot of carbonic acid. All right, that goes to your lungs, and what happens in your lungs? It takes CO2, right, that's in your blood, and you blow it out of your body, you exhale it from your body. What's going to happen to this chemical reaction in your lungs? Okay, this carbonic acid is going to be converted into CO2, right, and so that just aids in the excretion of CO2 from your body. Maybe I should have started in the tissue. What's happening in your tissues? What's being produced in your tissues? CO2 is being produced, so what happens to this reaction right here? It's driven to the right. This carbonic acid goes to the lungs, and in the lungs, You lose CO2, that drives the reaction backwards. And so that's just a nice way for your body to get rid of CO2 and transport it around. And that's catalyzed by carbonic anhydrase. So this is what we call Le Chatelier's principle. All right, who's got a question about that? Which way is this equation going to go if we put a lot of water into this chemical system? It's going to go to the right. If we take water away, which way is it going to go? Back the other way, right? That is just the law of mass action, or Le Chatelier's principle. And all chemical reactions are driven by that to some extent. Okay, let's look at some metabolic pathways. What the heck is a metabolic pathway? It's a sequence of enzymatic reactions that begin with some initial substrate and then progress through a bunch of intermediates. That's a key term, intermediates, and end with some kind of final product. So it's not just one simple chemical reaction. It's what? A series of chemical reactions that take place in steps, and these steps have to be operated in this particular order. So here is some initial substrate we call A. It can be converted into B, and if we want that to happen fast, what's a good idea to have an enzyme around that catalyzes that reaction? Then B gets converted into C with another different kind of enzyme, because B has a different shape than A, right? All right, and then C gets converted into D, and D gets converted into E. So here we see a number of steps, and then finally E gets converted into F, which is what we call our final product. And we're not going to spend a lot of time learning a bunch of intermediates in this class, but if you take a biochemistry class, it's going to be really important. We're going to learn some intermediates in here, not too many. So an intermediate is what? A chemical compound that is on its way into forming some kind of final product. So this one has five different enzymes, and it's got five different intermediates before the final product is produced. All right, so this is what we call a biochemical pathway, or a metabolic pathway. Okay, a lot of metabolic pathways have a branch point right here. So here we see A gets converted into B, and B into C, and then C can have two different fates. C can go into two different directions, right? And there might be two different enzymes that catalyze the fate of C. Here we have enzyme number 3, and here we have enzyme number 3 what? Do you see that little symbol right there? Okay, that's prime. That's just a little apostrophe right there. So enzyme 3 is a lot different than 3 prime. Enzyme 3 converts C into D, but enzyme 3 prime converts C into D prime. So this is a divergent pathway, which means that the final products are going to be different, either F or F prime, just as an example. Okay. So metabolic pathways are controlled by what we call end product inhibition. And in this bottom pathway, we see the buildup of F prime, and as F prime builds up, you think your body needs more and more of it. What might be happening with your metabolism as F prime builds up? Maybe the need for F prime is satisfied, and so you need to make more F prime if it's at its proper level in your body. Guess what? You don't need to make any more of it if it's at the proper level. So F prime is floating around inside the cell, and it goes back and it can bind to some spot on enzyme 3 prime. And when it does, it changes its activity. Right? It turns this enzyme off. So how would you explain the inhibition of enzyme 3 prime when it binds F prime? What's happening to enzyme? Yeah, that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. But when an enzyme when something binds to an enzyme, what happens to its shape? It changes conformation. That's like getting poked in the side. It's being poked in the side by the final product, changes its activity. So now, where does C go? Instead of down to the bottom pathway, it starts to go up to the top pathway and produce a different kind of product. All right, so that's a way that, so allosteric inhibition usually operates where there's a branch point in a metabolic pathway. Okay. Let's see. Oh, I think I deleted this one from your slide. You shouldn't have that in your slide. And you don't have this one in your slide. All right, so bioenergetics. Let's talk about bioenergetics before we really get into metabolism. And I think you've talked about this in lab already. The laws of thermodynamics, all right, refers to the flow of energy in living systems. The first law says that energy can be transformed, but it can't be created or destroyed. But before we start talking about this, what the heck is energy? Does anybody have an idea of what energy is? What is energy? I don't know if I like talking about all these concepts without knowing what energy really is. What is energy? Okay. So you probably have to take a chemistry or even better yet a physics class to have a good working understanding of what energy is. All right. Energy is just the ability to do work. All right. The ability to do work. So it's not like sliding downhill. It's what? Going uphill. Going against the concentration gradient. So some days you feel like you have very little energy. What does that mean about the amount of work that you can do? Very little, right? But some days you wake up and you have a lot of energy. What does that mean? You can do a lot of work, right? So energy is just the ability to do work, right? And the amount of energy in our universe is not changing. Energy can be converted from one form to another, but can't be created or destroyed. The second law states that energy transformation increase entropy, or the degree of disorganization in a system. So if things are going to happen spontaneously, that means that entropy has to increase, or the degree of disorganization. So our bodies are highly organized, right? And so in order for us to live, we have to think of what's the balance of entropy. Right, if our bodies are highly organized, one of the outcomes of our body is that it produces something that's highly disorganized in some other part of our living environment. Right, so there has to be a balance there. Right, and only free energy, that is energy that's in an organized state, can be used to do work. And in order to perform work, systems have to go from a highly organized state to a less organized state. So systems tend to go from states of higher free energy to states of lower free energy. Energy has to flow from high to low in order for a system to happen spontaneously. Okay. So here we have a bunch of CO2 and water molecules. This is, a lot of molecules, and it's a highly disorganized state. Okay, highly disorganized state, but there is this little green thing right here that can take carbon dioxide and water, and it can produce something that's highly organized. How is that possible to go from this disorganized state to this highly organized state over here? You need energy in order for that to happen. So there's energy trapped in chemical bonds of glucose, and as a result, the plant also produces oxygen. Right here. Right, so what does glucose spontaneously want to do? Glucose wants to go back down, right, release that energy and turn into carbon dioxide and water. It's just that plants have figured out a way to go the opposite direction as long as they have an energy source to do that. And that energy, what's that energy source? That is light. Right, so light is the energy source, so there is energy in light. So the second law dictates that all living organisms require the continual input of energy. Plants get it from the sun right here, and where do animals get it from? I'm very jealous of these plants, right? Because I can't go to the beach and then sit out in the sun and like drink a milkshake all day long. Okay, so plants really have a nice leg up on us. We have to get our energy from other organisms like plants, right, that can produce this sugar right here. So plants obtain this energy from sunlight. They use it to make high free energy molecules. from CO2 and glucose, and that high free energy molecule is glucose. And then we use that energy and glucose to combat entropy and power our bodies. And guess what organelle in our cells uses glucose to make energy available for our cells? Okay, for instance, that's what happens in the mitochondria. All right, so we're going to spend a lot of time looking at mitochondria. So this is sort of like the process that happens in our mitochondria. Here we have a glucose molecule, all right, which is this is going to be the reverse of photosynthesis. Here we have a glucose molecule, and we can combine it with oxygen to, what, release energy. So there's going to be high free energy in glucose, low free energy in carbon dioxide and water. And, of course, you can take a glucose molecule and put a flame underneath it, and what's going to happen? It's going to burn, right? And it's going to form carbon dioxide all of a sudden. What dessert does that all the time? Huh? Creme brulee. Brulee. So that's when you caramelize sugar. If you get carried away with it, all the sugar turns into like charcoal or carbon dioxide and water. Right? But our bodies take that glucose, and because we have enzymes, we can break all these bonds at a low temperature because what the activation energy has been reduced for all of these different chemical reactions. And as we break apart this glucose molecule that has high energy, that energy is released. And that energy can be used by the metabolic pathways that we are going to find inside the cell and inside mitochondria. So we have two different kinds of reactions, endergonic reactions versus exergonic reactions. And when you go from a molecule of high free energy to lower free energy, it's going to always release energy. And is that endergonic or exergonic? That's exergonic. What's the sign of delta G when that happens? I'm going to see if you've had that lab yet. Did you have this lab already? Okay, becomes negative, right? The delta G becomes negative if it is exergonic. All right, so it's very easy to break glucose down into carbon dioxide and water because these are all exergonic reactions, all releasing energy. Okay, endergonic reactions, on the other hand, require energy to proceed. Can you recall a slide that I showed you that is an endergonic reaction? How about this one right here? Taking CO2 and fixing it into glucose. This is an endergonic reaction because it requires energy, right? So it can still happen, but it requires a tremendous amount of energy in order for that to happen. Okay. All right, so what does our body do? It works by this system right here. It balances exergonic reactions and endergonic reactions. Right? Cells require constant inputs of free energy from the environment to buck entropy and remain highly organized. It does it by coupling endergonic reactions to exergonic reactions. All right, so what's everybody's favorite exergonic reaction? Is when you break ATP down, when you hydrolyze ATP. Right, that's a highly exergonic reaction. And for instance, another kind of chemical reaction is highly endergonic. For instance, like contraction of skeletal muscle that requires energy. So how can you take an endergonic reaction like muscle contraction and get it to work? You couple it with an exergonic reaction. And that exergonic reaction is what? The hydrolysis of ATP. So ATP is what we call the universal energy carrier. All right, so for instance, muscle contraction would be an endergonic reaction that's going to turn this little wheel right here. That's not very spontaneous, right? It has to be coupled to an exergonic reaction. So going from reactants to product is going to turn this wheel right here. That's very, very favorable. That's going to be, for instance, the hydrolysis of ATP. That's an exergonic reaction. And it couples, because of these gears right here, to what? Endergonic reactions that take place in our body, like, for instance, muscle contraction. So could your muscles contract if you didn't have any ATP, all right, to drive this wheel right here? Muscles won't contract, right? Because it needs that exergonic reaction. All right, so most exergonic reactions in your body, all right, we're going to see make ATP to drive other unfavorable reactions. They have to be coupled. And here is that molecule of ATP. So here you see three phosphate groups. Here are the high energy covalent bonds. All right, and this is the adenosine, and here is a ribosugar, and that is ATP. When we break this bond, we're left with ADP and energy that was in this chemical bond right here to run our bodies. So who has a feeling for how much ATP we need in our bodies? How much ATP do we need? Okay. Like, give me an example. How should you think about how much ATP do you need? I'm not sure if I told this class yet or not. I did? Right. Half your body weight in ATP. All right, and what I didn't tell you, what is the major use of ATP in your body? It's an active transport pump. It is just a sodium-potassium pump. It uses most of that ATP that your body makes all day long. Okay. All right, so we're going to see how different reactions make ATP. And you know what? I think I'm going to start here next time. Oxidation reduction reactions. All right, so make sure you sign the sign-in sheet, please. And let's see. If you have class tomorrow or Monday, guess what? It's a holiday. So no classes tomorrow or Monday. But we'll have class on Tuesday.